10 week.
Sorry, Linz, I always do that to you.
All right. It's take two. Welcome to Women Explore. We're 50 years strong and still exploring. This is our 50th anniversary series. Our last time of curating an entire lecture series with a title and 10 subjects underneath for lecture and discussion. So we are working our way through these 10 weeks with joy and sadness. And we will be on Zoom today and then in person next week and on Zoom again for our last one on the 10th meeting that we have. So we have co-created this series in honor of Liz Dotson Gray, who led us for more than 30 years and was an inspiring eco-feminist, a great lover of the earth, and a supporter and activist on behalf of loving the earth, and a challenger about what that truly means and how we live that life. And today, obviously, is dedicated to her, especially when she embraced the divine feminine and living with the seasons and living with all the messages of nature and informing ourselves as women about our lives in that way. So we try to present lectures and discussions that are thoughtful, original, and provocative. And today is hopefully one more of those by another woman that we really admire a lot, and our focuser, Paula. So I'm hoping this is a series that Liz would be very proud of as we still keep stretching our knowledge. She was learning up until the day she left us and left this world, always curious and always asking provocative questions. So our lecture today is called Our Home, Taking Care of Earth. And I just want to say on behalf of Liz one more time that she encouraged us not to say Mother Earth, because her concern is that once you call something mother, the patriarchy targets you, targets the word, and would target and not take care of whatever was called Mother Earth. So we are calling it Taking Care of Earth. And our focus will be presented by Paula Shenandoah. And I'm going to introduce her now. So Paula has lived in Cambridge since 1974, where she began her first job at the MCZ, Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology, as staff scientific photographer in research biology. Since she worked next door to the Divinity School, where TOP, now Women Explore, met for many years, this is how she found us. So that was almost at our beginning in 1973. Educated in photojournalism with a minor in biology, Paula witnessed innovative research in biology while working with biologists to illustrate scientific papers and lectures in the 1970s and 1980s. Paula grew up on a 46-acre farm in western New Jersey in Hunterdon County, known for its rollicking hills and lush farmland. Her family lives in a rural area in Franklin Township, which has the highest quality soil in the state of New Jersey. Paula is the oldest of six children and learned about natural resources and how to manage them from her parents, Bibi and Walter, who Bibi from her parents Bibi and Walter, who was a commercial cat and dog photographer and later a horticultural photographer. Bibi was a botanist. Paula's parents did all their work at home, earning a living and raising six children. So the fieldstone house, the landscape, the farm was and still is a resource that has benefited her family and community. Hence, Paula learned about stewardship. Paula also grew up with a collection of animals, cats through the years with such names as Tom, Minnie, Jet, Katie, Spook, plus a Belgian sheepdog named Kitty Dog, and a goat named April. There were a lot of mouths to feed, both human and animal. Again, having a sense of hardiness and respect for natural resources was an important component of living at home. So, Paula, welcome. You're muted.
Okay. Thank you. So I wanted to talk about this, our home taking care of Earth. And I wanted to focus this because I've been thinking a lot about stewardship in general. And yes, I grew up on a farm, but I really didn't participate really until many years into my adulthood. So I just wanted to I'm going to do a couple things. I'm going to tell you a little bit about this area of New Jersey and where we live, and then how we manage the land, which was an evolution. It was an evolution of learning with my parents. And then by the time my father died 4 years ago, there was a lot of management in place for the land that we could do. So, but I wanted to define stewardship to begin with because I actually had to look it up, even though I've been thinking a lot about it. So I just want to read a definition of stewardship is an ethical value that embodies the responsible planning and management of resources. The concepts of stewardship can be applied to the environment and nature, economics, health, property, information, theology, cultural resources. Stewardship is now generally recognized as the acceptance or assignment of responsibility to shepherd and safeguard the valuables of others, the valuables meaning resources. And others, when they use the word property, I've begun to see that in a larger segment. Like we have this property, but it's also part of the community. And how it gets managed influences what happens in the community. And again, these are things that I realized recently. Let me say recently, but there's an I want to just read a definition of environmental stewardship because this is care of earth. Totally. Environmental stewardship refers to the responsible use and protection of the natural environment through active participation in conservation efforts and sustainable practices by individuals, small groups, federal agencies, and other collective networks. So it goes individual to basically public policy practices that sustain the land, that sustain the environment. Resilience-based ecosystem stewardship emphasizes resilience as an integral feature of responding and interacting with the environment in a constantly changing world. And then I just wanted to, this type of stewardship, I'm reading this because I find it really key. This type of stewardship recognizes resource managers and management systems as influential participants in the natural systems that are serviced by humans. So it's like the big picture and then the small picture. And the big picture is our earth. And the small picture is, that I'll talk about is the land where I grew up. So we moved here in 1960, and we live in a valley. And the rolling hills, it's a geographical gift. There's a lot of rolling hills. So we have a valley, and then we have an upper field to the west and an upper field to the south. And then we face lots of flat, and then we face some flat fields. So it's the geographics of the land and the soil, and then there's a lot of fieldstone in this soil. So a lot of the fieldstone has been used to build houses, barns in this area. So our house is fieldstone, and it was constructed from the fieldstone in the fields. Now, we didn't do any of that, but it was through the years, starting in the late 1700s, and then the house was added onto as various owners needed more space. So to begin with, the fieldstone is used, and that's using a resource. But the also the part of the of this area that's very rich, so it's very rich soil, so it's good for farming. So again, when we moved here in 1960, it was all farms. And to tell you the truth, as a 12-year-old, I thought it was a little too quiet. Okay, it was really quiet here. And so eventually, so again, these were fields that needed to be managed. And so we had forests that needed to be managed. So basically, my parents evolved doing that. And now we have, so the land has also changed through the years because we've had storms. And so what I'm going to talk about is we have a forest in the upper Westfield that needs to be managed. And recently, because one of the changes is the ash trees that look like just regular trees to us are being attacked by the emerald ash bug.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to make a decision. So we're in a forest management program. So this is a program, a 10-year program, where you work with forest arbor people, and they you cull older trees so that younger trees can grow. So that's part of this forest management program. But, you know, the emerald ash bug is courtesy of lots of things. Climate change is one of them. And so we had to make a decision to take out these trees before they were completely decimated. And in logging them out before they were decimated, the wood could go to a purpose. So the wood could be used for lumber. So we had to cull like 75 trees. And to manage this, so you have to have someone come in, cut the trees down, do the whole thing. Then you've got a forest missing 75 trees. So my brother Sam is the one that manages the land. I mean, I listen to everything at the family meetings, but he's the one really keeping track of things. And so when these trees were removed, he said, well, now we have to replace them. And this is where I'm saying I'm on a learning curve. I said, oh yeah, why? you have to grow the forest. And if you take out things, in this case, because of the emerald ash bug, then we have to add trees. So this was just at the pandemic, so we couldn't do anything. So now we're back to thinking that we would add things like oak trees, maple trees, and a combination of trees. And the tree management people recommended all oak trees, 75 oak trees. But in speaking to Sam recently, he said, there's some disease coming up with oaks that I don't think we should just put all oaks in. So despite having a management, a forest management program where you have experts, you still have to be informed. And this is where climate change is coming in. It's kind of growing up here in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. You didn't have these assaults like the beetle, like the bug, or something that's coming up on oaks. So that's one aspect. So by not waiting, that's the whole reason to be in a management program. By not waiting for the trees to completely die, you get to save them and they get to be used for lumber. So then the other the other thing that we've done here is that there's a lot of mature trees here. Again, that was the gift when we moved here. There are big trees in the yard facing south, like a big oak tree, a big maple tree, and a big butternut tree. And this butternut tree is like, it just goes up and it stands out, and it's a huge canopy in the summer. And so knowing that this house started in 17, this area started, this house in this area started in the late 1700s. So these trees were planted like 100 years ago. So now, like the butternut tree needed help. So we had to have an arborist come and cable parts of it so that it would not die an early death, if you will, because the canopy goes up so big. And so then the arborist said to us, well, that'll give you another 20 years, which I think is amazing. And because we're in a valley, we're in like a warmer area. So this butternut tree has thrived for, I would say, 100 years. But when the arborist came, he said he had never seen a butternut tree this far north. It's a southern tree. Mm. So, you know, I never thought twice about it when I was growing up here. And probably my father didn't either, or my mother didn't either. It was just part of the whole situation. But now things are different. The trees are older. There's climate change. Like when we had the big storm, we had a very big storm. I think it was Ida a year ago, and it came inland. This is definitely inland here. It came inland, and if it had been a big wind, we would have lost that butternut tree because the canopy is so high. So I have to say that climate change is influencing how we take care of things. You have to kind of batten down the hatches, like cables in the trees, to keep things from being like the high winds that came with the hurricane. And then we're constantly planting the fields and with hay seed. And then the fields are, a farmer comes and he bales the hay. This is in June and July. And then the hay that comes from the fields here goes to not only for the animal, for cows and horses, but it goes to, in Pennsylvania nearby, near here, there's a whole mushroom center that grows mushrooms. So this hay is used in the mushroom growing. I think it's called Newitt Square or Newton Square in Pennsylvania.
Kennett Square.
What is it again?
Kennett Square.
Kennett Square. Thank you. Thank you. So the fields, again, the fields are, they can get overgrown with invasive species. So you constantly have to be pulling out invasive species. And we did that with one field across the way. And Sam, my brother Sam, told me that recently he just completely pulled out all the invasive species and a Douglas fir so that we could have another field to be seeded and to be productive. So all of this kind of goes in, comes together. And if you don't do one thing, things like invasive species of plants will overwhelm a field in no time. So you kind of have to be willing to keep at it. And the other thing we do is, you know, we plant plants that are like that are pollinators or that help, like butterfly bushes, fruit trees, and just a variety of just kind of keeping track, but not in a lavish, expensive way, but just to kind of keep the environment happy or circulating or whatever all those words are, to keep the land managed. So And then there's one more thing that we've done is that we have bees, and they're pollinators, and they, again, it just helps the whole environment. And again, during the pandemic, the bees left. Don't know why, but they just left the hive. So we have to start again and, you know, restock the hive. And a beekeeper helps us with that. We don't do it because we don't know enough. We don't know enough about it. So you kind of, we're part of the community where we know people who do that, who can help us with that. The same thing with the farmer who cuts the fields. So that's like the overview of what we're doing to manage and, to manage the land so that it's productive. And then that helps the community. Like, we're not letting that field get overgrown with invasive species, because then the birds eat the seeds and they fly all over. And, you know, it's more invasive species. So that's, one way of, so I'm just trying to wrap it up. It's definitely management, and it's definitely keeping track of things, keeping track of trees, fields, the forest. And it's been a learning curve for me personally. So, and all my siblings help with this. We all do it together, basically. And there's always one. Sam leads the way because he knows a lot about the land. And so that's my personal experience with caring for this little part of Earth. And I have to say it's involved. So that's what I have to say. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Paula.
Thank you.
So we have about 5 minutes for comments or questions. Mary Rose?
Paula, do you and your family anticipate keeping this property in the family forever?
That's a really good question. You know, what happens with this, I mean, I want to say yes. And if my father were here beside me, he would say definitely yes. But you know how it is with communication. He didn't say that to us. He didn't say, oh, you definitely have to keep this place. But it is that feeling, and it is something it's a legacy. It becomes a legacy when you're doing all this care of the land. And my father did all his work here. I mean, they did everything here. You know, if he was indoors photographing, he renovated a barn that's about 5 minutes away. And then otherwise he was always photographing outside. But the answer to that question is, yes, I think we envision that, but we haven't talked about the future. Like, I don't have kids. I have a stepson. But, and my sister has 3 kids. But as Sam said, when my father died 4 years ago, he said, listen, we're all old. I said, I'm not old. But that's the problem. That's the issue with legacy and with keeping it. Yes, I do envision keeping it, especially, you know, all that we do. But that's the other thing. If it goes to someone in the family, like one of my sisters or all 3 of my sister's children, they have to be willing to do all this.
Right.
And this takes time.
Do you all own it jointly right now?
Yes, we do.
Oh, okay.
We do. And my father, this was done before he died. Mm. He made us the owners. So it's 1/5. There's 5 of us now. My brother Enrico died about 25 years ago. So there's 5 of us, and we're 5 equal owners, which I don't mind saying to you that my patriarchal father did 5 owners instead of 1, like my brother. Okay. So that's a gift.
Yeah. Right.
Right. And so it's, you know, we have to have that conversation about the future, and we haven't yet. So.
Well, I want to ask you something. So I hadn't, you're maybe the first person who had such a big piece of land to steward. I love the word steward and resilient stewardship and eco stewardship. And I'm hearing how much work and learning and tending and tracking there is. And so my question is, can you do that with all that responsibility and still find joy in the 46 acres and all the different ecosystems in the 46 acres? And I don't, if that's a hard mixture because there's so much responsibility to do things like, do you have harvest celebrations or do you have ways to really be, have joy in all of the different pieces of your place?
I really like that question because if you talk to Sam, so who does every, he does all the land. He used to work in landscaping and then he went into business. So he has this eye that he likes jumping on his red Steiner tractor and he mows, he mows the lawn, but he's the one taking care of the fields and pulling out the invasive stuff. So if you ask him, he loves doing that, but he's there all day long sometimes. Okay, so asking about the joy, we have a family picnic reunion here every July, the last weekend in July. And people come and there's like cousins and all sorts of cousins and children of cousins, and there's like 60 to 80 people.
Whoa.
So that's one of the joys of maintaining this, that we bring together our family. But I know what you're saying about the do we have joy? Because, there's summer days when Sam's sitting here at the desk trying to deal with the forest management. And now we have to have a new plan coming up in 2020 or coming up. So far, I would say there's more joy than toil or than drudgery. But that's the question about envisioning who would, after we all die, who would be here? Would they find joy? Say, for instance, the way my brother Sam does.
Well.
So it's a good question. Just like Mary Rose's question is good, and these are all unanswered things. I can't figure them out yet. But so far, everyone really likes, like we talk about what plants we might plant, and I want to have more input on trees because, we had a bunch of fruit trees on the way to the barn, and they all died, but they were also like really old. So, we have good conversations about trees.
I remember when I was learning to garden and someone told me I had fruit trees and they said, then I was digging for a vegetable garden in the back, in the way back of my the place we lived. And they said, this is what I'm going to tell you. It's a like a little secret formula for farmers that you plant the peas when the leaves on the apple trees are as big as a mouse's ear. And I said, that. So I would look at my apple
It.
trees and look at that. I see it was as big as a mouse's ear, and then I could plant the peas. And I don't know. I just think there's stories, threads of stories like that all through
Yes.
farming. And
Yes.
well, thank you, Paula, so much.
Thank you.
I'm gonna go back at 1 o'clock for a group session, and then Paula will be part of that too.
Yeah, Ginger wanted to say, been trying to say something.
Oh,
Oh,
sorry.
I'm sorry, Ginger.
I didn't quite know how this works. Does someone call on you or you just jump?
I would be calling on you, or people remind me because sometimes people put a yellow hand up and I don't see it.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, so do you want to ask Paula something before we move on?
Well, it's actually a comment. And when you started your talk, it was interesting about you and your property as a part of a community. And so I wanted to go back to that thought. And what comes to mind is Margaret Renkel's columns in the New York Times about her life in the Nashville area. And she's always, well, not always, she has very wonderful columns, but whenever she's talking about her property, she rails against her neighbors who have pristine lawns and have the foggers come to keep the mosquitoes away. And she's the only one in her street or neighborhood who doesn't do it. And most recently there was an article about June bugs, lightning bugs, and remembering as a kid how many there were. Now they're very few. So that's another thing to think about. How do you interact with your neighbors? They read the column, no doubt, and you know she's got her opinion and they have theirs. But how do you get through and work through this tender, emotional, neighborly issue?
I'm laughing because it's also a really good question. And around here, like we live on a road a mile long, and when we moved here, there were 9 neighbors, and now I think there's like 15, 16 mm-hmm. neighbors. And I would say at first, everyone is of the same point of view about managing land and being kind to the land and seeing it as a resource. But I will also say to you that when farmers needed money, they were selling their land and it was getting developed. So it's really, the community is kind of composed of people who want to preserve the land and people who really want to use it for other things that might not be as resourceful. Now, lawns, a recent thing about that lawns are not great, but that's pretty recent, even though we've probably all known that. So I don't know what to say. We have neighbors and we've been lucky on the one hand. And on the other hand, there are some neighbors who have done some terrible things up on the Cherryville Road. Things like tearing out trees on a hillside. So then when it rains really hard, the hillside rocks wash down. So maybe she's good to call out people. I don't know. I wouldn't do that personally. Because I need to say hi in the grocery store.
Yeah.
But there are those two, definitely two forces in a community all the time. And there's a group here that was formed in the 80s called Rural Awareness, because so much land was being sold by farmers and it was being sold to developers. And it's the loss of farmland. So since the 80s, we've preserved a lot. So,
okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paula. Yeah, we have our own local stories, even in cities like Watertown and Russo's selling their place. And
yes,
the heartbreak of that. And okay, so it is time to turn our program over to our quote-unquote main speaker. So, Ginger, you're new here, but we have a history in the 50 years of saying, well, who do we want to learn from? And we don't start with, well, we could never ask them to talk. We start with, we can ask anybody to talk. So we want to hear from Anita Hill. We'll call her up. We mm-hmm. want to hear from E.O. Wilson. We'll call him up. We'll just tap anybody on the shoulder. So we did the same with Robin Wall Kimmerer, mm-hmm. thinking, well, I mean, you know, let's go to the mountain, right? And call her up. Well, Robin Wall Kimmerer's life has changed a great deal since the second sort of the braiding sweetgrass has been around quite a while, but it had quite a comeback during the pandemic when people were wanting to have more time with nature and sort of realizing what she provided nature. So she's now quite in demand and very expensive. The people who come and talk to us offer their time. Mm-hmm. So we weren't able to have her come, but we tried. And Mary Rose was on the front line of that pursuit. So our second best approach here is to Mary Rose has curated, collected, looked at a lot of different videos that Robin Wall Kimmerer has made interviews, and she's selected a couple of them for us to watch. And I'm going to turn everything over to Mary Rose right now to introduce Robin Wall Kimmerer. And then, Mary Rose, do you want me to take it up again at 1, or do you want to stay?
Oh, yeah, that would be fine, Linda.
Okay,
sure.
So yeah. when it feels complete, we'll go back into our group discussion, which will include more comments with Paula, which might come up as we watch and listen, and whatever responses we have to Robin's work. That's someone, a woman we are very, very grateful to and inspired by. So to you, Mary Rose.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. Just to follow up on what Linda just said, this book, which is Braiding Sweetgrass, for any of you who haven't read it, I have no idea, but it is definitely worth reading, and it's worth reading very slowly and meditatively. Each chapter is like a whole book, so that you could almost open anywhere. But anyway, she wrote it in 2013, but it didn't get to the New York Times bestseller list till 2020. And I just read this in the Washington Post. Sometimes books get popular because it's word of mouth that moves it along. Because someone reads it, they tell their friend, they tell their mother, they buy a copy, and it just becomes incredibly popular, which it did. And it was referred to as an invitation to celebrate the gifts of the earth. So I think each of these videos does a little intro of Robin. So I'll just read this one paragraph about her. And she is incredibly inspiring. She's now 69 years old and teaches in the SUNY system in New York. As a leading researcher in the field of biology, Robin Wall Kimmerer understands the delicate state of our world. But as an active member of the Potawatomi Nation, she senses and relates to the world through a way of knowing far older than any science. In Braiding Sweetgrass, she intertwines these two modes of awareness, the analytical and the emotional, the scientific and the cultural, to ultimately reveal a path toward healing the rift that grows between people and nature. The woven essays that construct this book bring people back into conversation with all that is green and growing, a universe that never stopped speaking to us, even when we forgot how to listen. So now, hopefully, Mary Ann's going to...